Hey, Dr. B.
Hey, Luke. How are things moving in your world today?
You know, they're a little crazy. I've been thinking lately, like, I think I've forgotten how to rest or how to relax. I just can't ever stop thinking about all of the work that I have to get done.
Oh, I so hear you. I feel like so many times we can get caught in this loop of constantly doing can make such a big difference in our capacity to just slow down and enjoy the moment. It's just, frankly, really stressful. Why don't we talk about that a little more?
We all get busy and stressed, but we don't have to live that way. If you don't know how to slow down and catch your breath, maybe you just need to talk to somebody. Check out Modern Therapy, a psychology practice here in Houston driven by one overarching mission: to cultivate a well-lived existence despite life's inherent challenges. Check out mymoderntherapy.com to make an appointment with Dr. Beatrice Craven or one of her associates. Again, that's mymoderntherapy.com. From Milieu Media Group, this is The H, a podcast about the people and places that make Houston, Houston. I'm your host, Luke Bronner, and this is Season 2, Episode 9, The Journeyman, with Thomas Chorba. November 8th, 2008, is a date I'll never forget. On that Saturday night, the band with which I spent essentially all of my 20s pursuing a music career finally got what felt like our big break. After years of striving and coming up short, we were invited to open for a band we'd idolized since we were teenagers. The very band that inspired us to buy our first guitars and with whose songs we learned to play those guitars. It was a dream come true. We rehearsed like crazy, brought in a couple of really great hired guns to fill out our sound, and frankly, played the best show of our careers for one of the biggest, loudest crowds we'd ever played. And when we finished, I had one of the most surreal moments of my life. When the lead singer of the headlining band paused early in their set and asked the crowd what they thought of us, as headliners always do. The crowd cheered, as crowds always do. It was an encouraging moment, but not terribly unfamiliar, as we'd opened for lots of bands in the past. But when the crowd died down, he looked down to the front row where I was sitting, looked me directly in the eyes, and told me he really enjoyed our set, that they'd had dozens of openers throughout the years, but that we really impressed him. I was completely floored. After struggling for so many years, I'd finally gotten the attention of one of my heroes, and he respected me. It was as if all my hard work was suddenly validated. Ironically, that wound up being one of the last shows our band ever played. Years later, in early 2015, while starting a new job in Houston, I was given a list of names and email addresses of volunteers I was responsible for overseeing. One in particular jumped out at me because the domain name in his email address was his first and last name. I assumed he was some sort of mid-50s oil and gas hotshot with his own consulting firm, but I checked out his website anyway and was pleasantly surprised to see that he was a musician. With low expectations, I clicked on one of the tunes on his media page and was pleasantly surprised once again when I heard this.
But if you were as sad as me, I'd be more satisfied. I don't know what I'll do without the love you had for me. I guess I'll get on this here boat and go out on the sea.
Needless to say, I was impressed. I never expected to hear a voice like that, or such a well-written tune. But the bigger surprise came a few weeks later, the first time I actually met him,
and realized the incredible voice I'd heard on that recording belonged to a 16-year-old boy, Thomas Chorba.
My name is Thomas Chorba. I'm from Houston, Texas originally, and I'm a songwriter and performer. I travel Texas a good bit and travel all around the country playing tunes for people.
Thomas grew up on the west side of town in Memorial as the youngest of four kids.
Being the youngest, I kind of followed in footsteps, as I think the youngest kid does, and learned from my oldest siblings' mistakes and kind of got to see people live life front row. You know, and I think that's the advantage of being a youngest sibling, is you get a front row view of people messing up and figuring out themselves, you know. And so as I was getting ready to step into who I was as a person, I got to watch three people that I knew very dearly and loved very dearly get to do the same. So I think that was a cool way to get to learn about the world, was watch three siblings do it.
He was closest in age to his sister Molly, then Avery, and then his brother Will, each of whom influenced him in different ways.
Molly was always the year above me in school, and so we were like kind of, you know, locked at the hip and hung out a lot in high school, and our friends overlapped, which was really cool. Interested in the same things, hung out with the same people. And then Avery and Will were kind of the pair that were older. Will's the oldest. He's an incredible musician, plays a lot of old-time music, and can play just about any instrument you give him, unlike me. He's so aware of the history of music. He's a musicologist more than anybody I know. And so learning from him was a big deal to me growing up. He had his, you know, troubles with school and education, but was super, and is super smart in the way that he understands philosophy and went to a liberal arts school where they write math papers instead of tests, you know, that kind of thinker. And watching that kind of blend with his love for music has been really interesting and will continue to be. So he's the oldest, and then Avery was the grade below him, always in school. And she's more of like the family tradition kind of gal. And she's great, super loving, and sang in church growing up, and I think I wrote my first song with her, you know. And so, yeah, music was kind of around with my siblings, but it was never like, not in a traditional way, you know, like a dad teaching you how to play a Black Sabbath lick or something. I don't know if that's a thing. I feel like it is.
His dad may not have taught him how to play music, but they certainly had a love for music in common.
It's interesting. My dad, maybe it was like a hidden secret, but he was like in bands and stuff in high school and college. Most famously, in our family, the band called The Potatoes. That's my father for you. I mean, he can still play the piano a bit, but as a kid, it was never, we never had a piano around. We never really talked about music. My mom and dad would sing to me when I went to sleep. And so my mom, being a Houston gal and a Texas girl, really sang old Willie Nelson songs. And that was just kind of in the water, I feel like, or kind of just like part of my environment, you know, this old outlaw country kind of stuff. And so, yeah, I think I took an interest there. I mean, I remember my brother learning guitar, I guess, when he was in high school. And I think anybody who learns how to play guitar, there's at least a portion of that desire because it's going to make you cool, you know? Guitar is just cool when you're a kid. And so watching my brother, I always had a romantic view of, like, music, I think, but never was able to flesh it out really until I got to being in high school.
Thomas didn't start playing guitar until his freshman year in high school, but his big brother's musical taste had already been influencing him for years.
He taught me about, you know, old Carter Family and stuff, lots of old 1930s blues guitarists and stuff, Lightnin' Hopkins and people like that.
The greatest musical introduction his brother made for him, though, was with the late Texas-born singer-songwriter Townes Van Zandt.
He told me about Townes when I was a kid. Townes is a distant relative of ours, and so Townes was an interesting character, right, and legend to some degree, because he, you know, died really young and had his demons, surely. The older part of my family who knew Townes and lived through that referenced that as a kind of a disgrace to the family, right? The vagabond who, you know, was rid of tradition and didn't really care about kind of the lineage that he was a part of. And so there's that part of my family, and there's me and my brother who were like, man, this is the coolest thing. We get the very small percentage of blood, but we get to share blood with this guy who's influenced us in incredible ways. And not only us, but worldwide, you know, has been a staple in, I think, Americana music. And so, yeah, he told me about Townes and was like, dude, we're related to this guy. It's like, what? You know, and I hated it at first. I really did, as I think many you know, uninformed listeners do, it takes a little while. It's like a, you know, it's an acquired taste, I think. But once you're there, it's just gold, you know, it's so good. So yeah, he introduced me to Towns, and he taught me a lot about lineage, right? And Towns' music exists because he loved Lydon Hopkins, right? It's like, okay, let me go immerse myself in Lydon Hopkins, right? And what influenced him to get there. And that musicology idea was super appealing to me and still is, and something I'm still trying to figure out and chase down.
So the influences of your influences.
Right, absolutely. And I think any, especially in Americana music, a big part of my job is to pay homage to those who came before me. And so I guess people ask me to define my music. It's like, well, I listened to a lot of this as a kid. Or like, I've been listening to this recently, so that's how this came out this way. Rather than like, oh, I got this new synth. So I think that's really interesting and maybe unique to Americana music more than other genres.
So at 15, he picked up a guitar, learned a few simple chords, and almost immediately began writing his first song.
It's called The Only Home I Know. And the melody and the guitar part came from a... It was me trying to play a Towns Van Zandt song that just I couldn't play, because Towns can play. It's just effortless and seamless the way he does it. So yeah, I was trying to play a song called Dead Flowers, and it didn't turn out so well, so it ended up being one of my tunes, and I showed it to my sister. She was like, oh, let's write another verse, and we did. And it was really exciting.
There's been laughter, there's been tears. All those memories are what got us here. Dumb decisions and big mistakes. Lessons learned and old heartbreaks. When we're old, we'll sing together like we did when we were young. All the time we've spent together will never be enough. When I'm gone, you bring me flowers. When I'm dead, you visit my grave. When I'm gone, you know I'll be singing my way. Through heaven's gates. I've got time and I've got freedom. All those memories, yeah, we're gonna need them.
He wrote a few more tunes and then decided it was time to share them. So he called up his youth pastor at the time, who also happened to be a member of Houston-based folk band Brother of Pearl, Tyler Richards.
I was playing in a band at the time, and I think he'd asked me to come listen to some music he had written. I went over to his house, and I was kind of like, okay, you know, let's see what he's writing, thinking it to be like most high school music. And as soon as he opened his mouth, I think the first thing that just jumped out to me was the richness in his voice was really way over his age group. And then the first song he played, I was like, you know, I've listened to a lot of music. I've been around a lot of people performing live. Not a lot of people have a voice like yours. You have to do something with it. That was just what I thought. I mean, it was special. Most people, I would say, oh, you know, that's fun. You know, go to college or something. But I really thought he was special from the first moment I heard him sing.
So I played him a couple of songs. He was like, they suck, but we can work on them, you know. And was like, hey, if you want to do this thing, you've got to write every day. Maybe not explicitly, but that's what I picked up from the advice I got from him. And quickly learned about the discipline and the kind of blue-collar aspect of making music. He taught me about the discipline, and I spent a little bit of time writing every day. I told myself it was every day, but I cheated all the time, right? I was a kid. I showed him these songs. I had like 10, 11 songs. He was like, hey, my friend Brian, who did my record, would love to work with you.
Brian is Austin-based artist, producer, and multi-instrumentalist Brian Douglas Phillips, known by many simply as BDP. He's responsible for some of the most iconic Texas singer-songwriter albums of the last 15 years, including artists like David Ramirez and Penny and Sparrow, each of whom have been huge influences on Thomas. This is Brian.
So I was working with Tyler. He was doing the Brother Pearl stuff. You know, we were kind of in the midst of that project, and he said, I know this sounds weird, but I've got this dude I want you to hear. He's part of my youth group, but he's excellent. And so I was like, okay, that's cool, man. Send some tunes along. And I pretty much immediately was blown away by the maturity of Thomas's songs. They kind of had this rawness to them. You know, it was kind of like this really beautiful, unpolished thing that just seemed really fresh, but somehow like wise beyond its years too.
So he got to work raising money to pay for studio time by touring around to college towns, playing shows at house parties and selling t-shirts he'd had printed. Before long, he traveled to Austin, and he and Brian got to work on his first EP entitled Kentucky.
I wanted to do 10, 12 songs, and I remember verbatim Brian saying, let's do 5 really badass tunes instead of 10 really half-ass tunes. It's like, that's wise. You know, this guy cares about me and these songs. And it was something else. I remember being in that studio just like wide-eyed, wanting to touch everything. We recorded kind of the base of that record to tape, which was kind of nuts to me. And I mean, I didn't know any different. I didn't know anything about Pro Tools, but to actually see my song being put on something physical was really crazy. I remember thinking I would walk into that studio and it would be like me and a guitar, just me and a guitar. It'd sound really good, I guess, spending money for it, right? But no, we had a drummer and full band, and BDP plays everything. And so there were basically 3 of us that played on that record, and me, him, and a drummer, Fred Mondujano. And it was an incredible experience. I mean, looking back on it, it's like cringeworthy. Some of the lines and some of the guitar, my acoustic guitar parts are out of time. But it's cool to have a physical representation as to where I was at that time in life. Not lyrically or anything like that, but just emotionally and mentally. It was like what I wanted, to be able to hop in a studio at that age and do it. It was like, oh, I was really hungry for something that I didn't have, you know. And Brian's become a great friend and a teacher and a guide in a world I had no idea about when I was that age.
Tell me about releasing that record. You released at a time when young artists, they sound very different than what you were doing.
Yeah.
How was it releasing an album at 16 that sounded like that?
Well, one, I think I was pretty unaware of the music industry as a whole. This was in 2014, and so I was completely unaware of the music industry as a whole. Justin Bieber was just like an image, right? And the idea of anybody creating anything, I didn't think about. You know, it's just like, oh yeah, I made these songs with this guy, and I'm going to go play some shows. And so I released that record on a Friday. It was April 25th, and it was like something out of a movie. It was hilarious. It's like walking around school. You know, it's like you do a twist around the lockers, like point your fingers, you know. It's like, hey, man, congrats on the album. It was like a sense of legitimacy. Because leading up to that, I was like, yeah, I'm a musician, you know, tell people that. But to have a record out, and teachers, really, English professors and history professors especially, be like, hey, that's really cool what you're doing. That meant way more to me than the jock that, like, was a jerk to me before. You know what I mean? And so it was cool. I mean, I think if I would have put anything out, though, a lot of those high school kids would have been like, dude, that's so cool. Like, you've got stuff on iTunes, which I felt that way, too. It's like, I've got something on iTunes. How crazy. But we played a release show at Walters downtown, and I had seen David Ramirez play there like a few months, I guess, before we booked my show. And so, like an artist I really respect, to watch him play that stage and then go play it at that time was like something out of this world.
How'd it go?
It was a blast. There were people there, which was crazy to me. I sold some t-shirts, you know, which is kind of the dream. You want to like have your merch out there. And as a, I guess, 16-year-old kid at that time, it was something else.
Thomas didn't linger long in the glory of his first album release, though. He was steadily improving as a guitarist, lyricist, and vocalist, and continued writing almost daily.
There was a year span in there I wanted to make another record. And this is where the Houston thing comes in, because now I had something that kind of gave me a little credit. I at least had a CD to hand to somebody. And so I remember we had the tunes ready. We were about to go in the studio with Brian again. And I brought my old CD into Man Ready Mercantile down in the Heights. And Christian Watson was at the register. I said, "Hey, man, do you know who does like the graphic design stuff for the shop and for you guys?" He's like, "Yeah, that's me." I had no idea who the guy was. I was like, "Cool, well, I'm a musician. Here's my CD. I'm looking to do artwork for a new record." And he was so kind. He's like, "Cool if we play your CD in the shop?" It's like, "Yeah, it's great." You know, little did I know he was working with people like Ralph Lauren and like crazy brands, and was kind enough to do an album cover. And so relationships like that started to come about, just because I feel like had some legitimacy just to have a CD, you know. And that's where I was kind of able to branch out, I think, and really meet people and really get my bearings straight, or I guess begin to get my bearings straight in this kind of music climate or creative climate, I guess. So yeah, there was a big paradigm shift, I think, in between the first and second record. I viewed making music differently. I sang differently. I wrote differently. I played guitar more in time, you know. But yeah, it was really cool. I mean, in just a year, to see how much I had changed. Again, a great time stamp is to see where I was in at that stage of life.
So tell me about the second record.
It's called Hard Truths and Noble Lies. And the idea was to kind of unpack some harder topics. You listen to Towns's like tunes like Nothing are like so heavy. You're like Waiting Around to Die. Obviously, you can just hear the title if you don't know the song, you know. And know that that's a heavy thing, that song probably is packed. And the first record maybe didn't have that, because there weren't all like my own experience. I was able to kind of portray other people's experiences. Like Papa's Blues was a, you know, tune about my grandfather and his kind of journey. But when it becomes my journey, it seems like there's a little more on the line. So that's what I felt like that little EP was kind of showing.
So as a senior in high school, Thomas released his second, much more personal album, which opened with a tune called Sweet Marie, about his sister Molly, whose middle name is Marie, heading off to college.
I talk about this a lot with my friends, just like I've never really experienced close death in the family or like with friends. And so when Molly, my sister, was graduating from high school, it was like losing a best friend, you know. And so that's what that song is about.
Confidence in everything you do. Stubbornness that you know the truth. Willingness to deal with me. I love my sweet Marie. Sweet Marie, I can't see why you had to abandon me. But there's a whole world waiting for you, my girl. So I will wait for spring. Close eyes, they see right through me. That smile, it shares your story. One of brokenness and one of healing. I miss my sweet Marie. Sweet Marie, I can't see
you had to abandon. But there's a whole world waiting for you, my girl. So I will wait for spring. It's not easy to stay calm. I grow weary the longer you're gone. But I am trying to keep from crying, waiting for the day when you return. I can't see why you had to up and leave. But there's a whole world waiting for you, my girl. So
while the second album showed tremendous growth musically, lyrically, and artistically, like so many sophomore releases throughout music history, its reception fell a little flat when compared to his debut.
I feel like it was a bit of a flop to some degree. But no, I think it's because I was in the same bubble. This is the same culture, same climate that I was in. And I had already... What made releasing Kentucky cool was that it was uncharted territory for me and for other people to watch me be in uncharted territory. Second one was just like, oh yeah, he's a musician. So we already know that. Digging into the tunes isn't low-hanging fruit, you know? It's easy to just be like, oh man, you're a musician, that's awesome. And that's a lot of what I was surrounded by. But digging into my lyrics and thinking about the Friday nights that I wouldn't be at a party and that I would be in my room writing, which was most Friday nights, if people would consider those things, they would probably view the tunes maybe a bit differently. I don't know. And maybe I hold my work too highly in my mind in that regard, but I guess that second record was just not something new. It wasn't new to people because people weren't actually digging into it.
Once the album was released, it was time for Thomas to start really weighing his options as his high school career was drawing to a close.
I wanted to not go to school, not go to college, and I have parents who want me to go to school and college, and who had planned financially for me to go to college. And there became a time that it was like, all right, I guess I'm going to school.
So with reluctant obedience, in the fall of 2015, Thomas moved north to Waco, Texas, to attend Baylor University as a business major with an emphasis on entrepreneurship.
And it was fine. You know, I got to be in a different environment, got to meet crazy amounts of people, right? And experience the world in a different way. But at that time in my life, it was like, I'm ready to do this. I'm a musician. I've released 2 records, and I'm going to go make a record and then go tour for 6 months. It's going to be awesome. And looking back, it's like, man, you were such an idiot to think that. But yeah, it was an interesting and frustrating time, but time kind of like makes you look at things differently.
To his surprise, he quickly fell in love with his new town. As for his major, however, that wasn't quite the case. He knew almost immediately that business wasn't the path he wanted to pursue, so he changed his major to English.
English has been incredible. It informs my writing in, you know, inexplainable ways, both in what I'm reading and writing in class, but also just conversations I have and the people I'm around, similar thinking people, you know.
Once he was out on his own with 2 really strong records under his belt, he began touring around playing shows on weekends and evenings and just about any time he wasn't in class.
I'll play a show on a Thursday, have an 8 a.m. class on a Friday, right? An hour and a half drive after playing College Station or something, right? And people will say, man, how do you balance school and music? And usually people that ask that question are people that are in a fraternity or sorority, people that are involved in Young Life, whatever it is. it's like, man, how do you balance being in Young Life and, you know, doing school? It's like, I'm no different than you. It's just mine, what I have at hand is a little more on my sleeve, I think. I'm traveling a lot. There's a geographical aspect as to what I'm doing. But man, like, I'm surrounded by awesome people. People that want me to go tour. People that would rather me go play a show than sit at home on a Friday night and do nothing. And friends like that that aren't offended by the work I feel like I have to do. Friends that really want me to go and do it have made it, not easy, but have made it doable, you know. And being in Waco is great. It's right in the middle of everything geographically. I can go play Austin and College Station and Dallas and Houston. Oklahoma City's not that far. You know, I can get to the southeast moderately easy, you know. Being in Texas especially is just like a gift, I think.
As he traveled around playing shows and building a fan base, he began dreaming about a third album, his full-length debut, a project he'd record the summer after his freshman year. But this time, he didn't have to dream alone.
It was fun, man. I had a buddy, my first quote-unquote manager, my friend Carter Smith, who was helping me with everything. And he was studying marketing, I think, and he went to Memorial High School as well, so I knew him from high school. He was just one of those people that was like down to help out, you know, and down to be a part of it. And those kind of people have always floored me. It's like, really? This is really something you're going to sacrifice your time for? And he was incredible. It was cool to have somebody to talk about the project with. Because leading up to it, it was totally myself. I would hire a producer. I would hire a drummer. I would hire a graphic designer or something. It's like, hey, this is what I want. And for the first time, it was like there was a team around it. And that was just a really cool and special thing.
He and Carter decided the best way to involve his growing audience in the project was to crowdfund it, successfully raising over $12,000 in just 30 days using Kickstarter.
That was a really, really special time for me to get to do that and to rally the troops to some degree. I think we had 90 people that all backed it. And to think there are 90 people in this world that are willing to give money for me to make a record, that's a heavy thing. And it makes you view the art differently. Maybe not the art itself, but the whole process, and makes you care for it in a certain kind of way. Is this is bigger than me. You know, this isn't just something I'm doing for myself. This is something that can mean something to people. And that's shown in, like, after a show, somebody comes up and says, hey, this is what this song means to me. And it is, like, way off the wall, and I never could have thought of it that way. Music takes life, I think, in the hands of the listener, because everybody brings something different to the table. A different experience, a different past, and a different hope for the future, I think. And so I think I thought about those things in releasing that record. I thought about the idea that something's on the line, that this is for people. People are going to try to connect with this in some way. It's not me standing up on a stage and screaming truth. It's me getting to connect with people and making people feel together. There's a togetherness around it. So I think it was really different in that regard. And the Kickstarter was cool because it was a tangible representation of that. People came together and were organized in order for me to get to do the thing, you know? And that was the goal. It was a big project. I feel like I expected something different of myself, and I knew there were a small handful of people that expected a good record, a small handful of people. You know, it's not like this is a huge scaled thing, but there was something on the line, I felt like. First full-length record, it was an actual thing, and I wanted it to be really special. And I think it was. I think the way we handled it was in that way.
The title of the record was From the Foxhole, and it was produced once again by Brian Douglas Phillips. It released almost a year later in 2017, and once again showed remarkable growth in both Thomas's writing and musicianship.
Someone once told me I was born to tell the truth and share it with the people around me. So I picked up a pen and wrote down what I knew. Didn't realize I was only searching. There's nothing about a microphone that makes me better than you. Wanderers and seekers just the same. I guess I'm just bold enough to address my weary blues and sing these songs for you today.
Someone said it would be easy playing songs from town to town. But life in the foxhole was given to me, and I don't want to ever let you down. Well, the 10-2 brings back my weary blues. This interstate can't fulfill me. Playing these shows and meeting new folks keeps my wheels a spinning. Well, no one said it would be easy playing songs from town to town. But life in the foxhole was given to me, and I don't wanna ever let you down. I don't wanna ever let you down. No, I don't wanna ever let you down.
Since the album release, Thomas has maintained an active presence on the road with a growing audience in every city he plays, all while continuing to do what it takes to finish his degree. And his family has supported him every step of the way.
Definitely supportive. Absolutely. They want me to do the things I feel like I need to do. They want me to pursue what I'm passionate about. Especially when they see tangible things. People show up to shows, right? To them are like, oh, wow, like he's actually kind of doing it. I feel like in my mind, that's the way I look at those kind of things. But also this, like, it's like, you're going to get that degree though, aren't you? It's like, yeah. And we just shouldn't talk about it, you know? And so there's definitely that. It's like, Thomas, you're going to get your degree. You're going to do the things that are required of you within this family. But also like, hey, if you're doing the things you're required of, then go get them, you know? Have a blast and meet people and influence people and do the things you need to do. And so it's really interesting, you know?
What has that experience been like for you of getting to work? As you tour around, you're seeing bigger crowds of people who know you who are coming out to support you.
It's incredible. Like, I really don't know how to describe it. It's like the difference between, like, a superstar and a journeyman, right? My goal is to kind of play for the front row, whereas I think a superstar plays for the back row. There's always, it's always growing. So that's just another way to say, like, if 5 people show up to the next show I play, that doesn't make me any worse of a songwriter, any less of a hard worker or anything. It's just like a fire, I guess, under my butt to keep working harder, you know, and to think about the business of it. It shouldn't matter how many people show up. It shouldn't change the art. It shouldn't change the delivery of a line. It shouldn't change the way I care for people, whether there are 5 people at a show or 500. Like, the way I view my art and the way I view the audience, it's as if the two are thought about separately in my mind, you know? And certainly there's a point where it's like, okay, I need to make money to do this, right? But it doesn't bother me that much when people don't really show up. For some reason, it's like, oh, cool, I got to play for 5 new people tonight, you know, and they got to experience the songs. That's incredible. It's really an indescribable kind of feeling when people get to hear something for the first time. You can tell they're on the edge of their seat. You can tell they're listening and they're really attentive in that way.
And who's paying attention? How would you describe your audience generally?
It differs from city to city, I think. College Station, where A&M is, obviously a lot of college kids, but places like Houston, Austin, too, kind of draw an older crowd. And part of that's venue, too. It's like, I've gotten to play Cactus Cafe a handful of times, and there's like a built-in older crowd that understand the tradition of that place and the legend of Cactus Cafe. And so they'll show up no matter who's playing. And if they think that what I'm doing is representative of the tunes they've loved their whole life, then they'll hop on board. I love playing for that age group, that demographic. I think those people like really care about turn of phrase and really care about my care for the art. I played a show in Baton Rouge for the first time. Never played Baton Rouge before. And man, it was incredible because there's some college kids there, right? But it was like split 50-50 between older folks and college kids. And it's a small listening room. It's just me and a guitar. Probably 100 people packed into this room. First time I ever played, you know. It was incredible, you know. It's a crazy feeling to get to connect with people in a place I've never stepped foot in. And those people, usually the older folks, are ones that really eat it up. But I'm glad to play for anybody. I mean, I'm learning that, like, I'm playing a show at 1-to-1, which is a bar in Austin. It's like, okay, I got to have a full band, and I've got to know how to shred and melt faces, you know, I guess, whatever. But places like Cactus Cafe or The Guru and Baton Rouge, it's like, okay, it's a different delivery method, I think. So I think you have to know your audience in that way and know your environment in that way.
So tell me about the vision. What do you want to happen?
The vision. Vision is so broad, you know, because I have a vision as to the kind of shows I want to play. I have a vision as to the records I want to make. When I step in the studio and make a record, I want to make a record that is unlike anything I've done before, that shows a different side of me, but that also references that which has influenced me. People like the Staple Singers, as well as Willie Nelson, you know. And I want to make a record that is able to encapsulate two very different ends of the spectrum at the same time. So I guess the vision would be to keep making records, records that I'm really proud of, and playing shows for people that mean something to people. You know, I think in a political and social climate that seems very turbulent, a lot of my job on stage is to be kind of a leader in togetherness. There's a sense of togetherness that we get to feel when we go to a show. I think that's really significant. As long as I keep getting to do that, and as long as I get to keep, you know, making records and developing relationships that I'm really proud of and believe in, I'm good, man. It's going to be fun. I mean, I can't quantify the value that I've of things I've learned over the past 6 years. And I can't imagine what that's going to be by the time I'm 55 or 60 and somebody tells me, all right, man, you can't play shows anymore. You know, when that day comes, it's going to be a crazy thing to look back on all this.
You know Willie Nelson still plays shows, right?
Yeah, he's 83. Holy smokes, man.
I think you'll be fine at 55.
I don't know. My back's already starting to hurt.
So you call yourself a journeyman.
Mm-hmm.
What is the end that you're striving for?
That's a great question. I think that's the difference between like a superstar, right, and a journeyman is my goal is to travel, to make records, to meet people, experience this world, and have lasting conversations and relationships. Whereas I think a superstar is somebody who's like, yep, once I get a Grammy, it's going to be great. Or once I get blah, 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 it's going to be great. Or once I play the Ryman, it's going to be great. It's like, man, I want to play the Ryman. I wanted to play Letterman when I was a kid, you know? That's not going to happen. That doesn't make me any less of a songwriter. That doesn't make me any less of a value to my supporters, I guess.
So where do you find validation in this? Like, what is it that kind of fuels that confidence for you?
I think it's personal. I know when I write a song and I finish writing a verse, I can sit back and be like, all right, that's what I'm proud of, you know? But I'll tell you also, sitting down with my best friend Dylan in Waco and playing him a new song is more nerve-wracking than playing in front of people. Because I care about him and the way he views me and thinks about my music, that fear, I guess, or that like that kind of heaviness that is in sharing music with somebody so personally, that's always going to be there. And I love that. Granted, his validation doesn't make my music worthwhile or not, but those kind of things are important to me. It's like, how do my friends feel about this? These people I really respect, and these people know me. They're able to give me like a check yes or check no on whether or not they think this is true to who I am. And that's a big part of the goal, is making stuff that's true to me. And so having friends that really care about that within me is really important. But yeah, I think it's personal. I think it happens within me and like the very tight-knit group of people around me that know me and care more about me than the art itself, I think. So I guess that boils down to relationship, right? It's like, as long as I'm able to do this without sacrificing the friendships and relationships that matter, it'll be a success.
Thomas has already learned a lesson I never did in all my days pursuing a career in music. He's learned who really matters. His family and close friends. The folks who are most invested in him, not only as an artist, but as a person. He doesn't need anyone's approval or validation. He operates with the confidence that he is loved and supported by those who matter most. I've spent far too many years of my life seeking the approval of those I admire, only to learn in the most painful ways that the respect of our heroes is, with very few exceptions, a treasure far too rare to be worth pursuing. A treasure that perhaps we only really find when we're not looking for it. Thomas has heroes, to be sure, and he hopes that the art he creates will honor and reflect their influence in his life. But that isn't why he creates. Their respect isn't what fuels or validates him. And the irony is that in creating in that way, he has earned their respect. The respect of former youth pastors like Tyler Richards, who recognized his potential in its most raw form.
It's a real privilege and a real joy to see somebody doing what you feel like they're gifted to do. In any career, in any sort of situation, I think in music with somebody so young, it's really fun to watch them go from a state of disbelief and insecurity, and then that growth is, oh wait, maybe I really can do this, and then starting to own that. You know, more than anything, it's just a privilege to be a part of his story and what he's doing, because I think he has some really great music ahead of him. So at this point, I'm just a fan, enjoying what he's putting out there.
The respect of record producers like Brian Douglas Phillips, who lead him, guide him, and point him down the right paths musically.
One of the most enjoyable things to watch has been seeing Thomas's shift in confidence and stage presence over the years. You know, I can remember playing shows with him down at, when he was doing release shows for Kentucky, we played down at Walters downtown in Houston. And, you know, he made it through, but he had this tenderness about him. And then, you know, I played with him a couple weeks ago, and it's just a whole different beast. Like, he's confident, he's having a great time. He knows how to command a room in the way that he needs to. That's been one of my favorite things to see. But of course, it's also been cool seeing him learn to use his own songwriting devices to their greatest strength. His songs have gotten better, become more calculated. And like, honestly, there was something about that early stuff too that was really great because it was so raw and seemed so honest. But now he's taken that and given it another, you know, layer of thoughtfulness. It's been nice to see his growth in that way. I think one of his strengths as a songwriter is storytelling. He's able to kind of look at the human experience and synthesize it in a beautiful way in his songs, like big arcs of human experience, and helps boil them down into nice stories. One of the things that I value really highly in songwriting is the idea of don't tell me, show me. And he's able to do that because he paints these pictures, he tells stories, he writes characters in his songs, which is something that I put a real high price tag on, and I think it's great. It's the proper way to me to express something instead of just, you know, flat out like naming an emotion by name, like paint me a picture that puts me in that emotion. Thomas is able to do that. And without getting too far into the age thing, like he was doing that when he's 15 years old. And so, you know, I of course like was envious, you know, thinking, man, if I could have been doing that when I was 15, who knows what the possibilities would be.
The respect of fellow artists like Andy Baxter of Penny and Sparrow, who challenged him to grow as a performer and show him how to command an audience.
I remember thinking early on, jealousy is maybe one of the first things that came to mind, mostly because he sounded like all of my heroes, and I've just tried to emulate the sound of Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark and Slade Cleese and all these guys that I've been listening to for years. And it basically I cut my teeth on when it came to learning to love folk music, Americana music, and storytellers. And it seemed to him like, I mean, there was this kid, teenager, when the time that I met him, and he already sounded like those guys, and his playing was already good. And, like, I remember, I'm looking back on the music that I made when I was 16, 17, 18 years old, and it was entirely shit. Like, now there's no redeeming qualities about anything that I did when I was around that age. And yet I listened to this kid, and I remember thinking, the best kind of jealousy. Like, it was the challenging kind of jealousy, the kind that made you want to immediately go and write great lyrics and go and work on your craft so that you can still hang and be relevant. And I love that because I feel like some of my favorite people under the sun, when I hear their stuff, their stuff makes me want to go make more. And his is no exception. I've wanted to make music every time he sends me something new, which thankfully I've gotten to hear some of the stuff that he's working on before he releases it. I find myself challenged, impressed, and creatively inspired to keep going and making more stuff. Thomas never even told, like, he may think that he did, but it was a surprise to see that we were mentioned in the thank yous of his album. And it was one of the more flattering, beautiful things, just because he sent us a copy and I opened it up and listened to it. And hey, I loved it. I mean, I love the record. Then I open up the back and then I realize that our names are on it as thank yous. And I got like heavily emotional because this is the first time that I think I actually believed that you don't think that you're in a position to be looked up to. You know, I just didn't think that we were ever in a position to have other people be like, hey man, your art makes me want to make art. And it's funny just because like I said that about him, and to know that it's reciprocated is a really, really big deal. I just sort of looked at it every time we talk about music as being a brother in arms who was going through the same stuff of insecurity and doubt and wanting to be good at the craft that he was. And so every time we talk, it never felt like big brother, little brother. It just felt like friend. And so to be looked at in any positive light by the guy is a pretty cool thing to me. Honestly, it's an honor to be included on a podcast that venerates him.
And the respect of master songwriters like David Ramirez, who show him what it looks like to explore the very depths of human experience and the search for words that ring true, and to never stop growing in your craft.
When I first heard Thomas, it was when he first did his first EP with Brian Douglas Phillips. Brian sent me a copy, and I was in my car, and my first thought was, there's no way he's 16 or whatever he was at the time. I think I was just really moved and inspired by just his ability to understand music in a way that a 16-year-old didn't, just to understand music and melody as a 16-year-old, but also just the depths of which he could pen a lyric. It was impressive. And the music's only gotten better, you know, and so I'm glad that he's still doing it. And I remember BDP and I just saying, yeah, he's only going to get better from here. So I've been stoked to see that happen.
Well, I was born in Houston, of all places, where Towns was regarded as a king. I had nothing to lose but these downtown blues, so I ran around chasing my dream. Education for the sake of my father, writing for the sake of myself, it was the one thing I knew that I'd never lose, my lifeline from the bottom of a well. Well, don't you know that these songs that I sorrow is a pin and a blank yellow sheet. Well, the cancer came right near the holiday. She spent Christmas in a hospital bed. Winter turned spring, and I forgot everything about living. We buried my sister in Memphis, the place where our ancestors lay. Well, the roses were pretty, but I screamed from within me, why'd you have to leave us this way? Don't you know that these songs that I wrote, sorrow is a pin and a blank yellow sheet. Well, don't you know that these songs that I wrote come from deep within me? The
sorrow is a pin and a blank yellow sheet.
Huge thanks to Tyler Richards, Brian Douglas Phillips, Andy Baxter, David Ramirez, and Thomas Chorba for being a part of this episode. You'll find links to all of their respective music in the show notes for this episode. Thanks, as always, to you as well. There are 3 episodes left in Season 2 of this show, and I'd love to hear your ideas for guests for Season 3. Feel free to email me at luke@theh.us or reach out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at The H Podcast. Thank you, friends. We'll be back in 2 weeks with Episode 10. This episode of The H was produced and edited by me, Luke Brauner. Our artwork is by the amazing folks at Spindletop Design in the Heights. Check them out at spindletopdesign.com. Our theme song is by Robbie C., and other songs featured in this episode are by Scott Benton, Cameron Pissera, and of course, Thomas Chorba. This and every episode of The H is brought to you in part by Pink Cilantro, a social-first digital agency focused on branding, marketing, and a ton of other great stuff. Visit them online at pinkcilantro.com. Now here's a scene from our next episode.
I walked in and there was a guard there and there was a chair and it said, "Do not come in, we're not open." So I went in and I said, "I want to audition for your school." She goes, "Oh my gosh, that's so funny. I just got a cancellation for Tuesday afternoon at 4:40. She called me the week later and broke protocol and said, "I just have to call you. You're like a homeless person that walks off the street and you just got into Juilliard." So it was just really, it's pretty interesting.